Okay. Let's move to the next issue, which doesn't get any easier. In recent years, few issues have created more challenges and debates in the U.S. than the issue of immigration and immigration reform. There are millions of undocumented immigrants in the United States, and many are of Hispanic origin, predominantly from Mexico. The concern for national and therefore border security in a post-9/11 U.S. has driven much of the conversation on one side of the debate. On another side of the conversation, we hear much from a variety of business, agricultural, and economic interests that advocate for a steady supply of workers to sustain the vitality of service and agricultural industries and maintain and increase profits. There is yet another side of the debate that highlights not the political or economic dimensions of the problem, but rather the moral dimension, the ethical aspect, the human face, if you will, of immigration. That is to say, the humanitarian, family, and justice concerns that are involved in decisions about migration and their place in immigration laws. There are sincere Christians on all sides of the debate. The conversation at times has become so heated, however, that among Christians there is a lack of clarity about what role our churches should assume. Is the Christian's role to find a way to serve the undocumented immigrant in the community with the gospel and the work of mercy, which flows from the gospel? Or is the Christian's role to denounce and have deported the undocumented alien? Christian faithful to the gospel, citizen faithful to the law of the land. How do we deal with the apparent and, why not even real, tension between the Christian's commitment to the church's mission of proclaiming the gospel to and serving all immigrants without distinction, whether legal or illegal, and his or her desire to uphold the nation's laws, in particular those that deal with immigration? After looking at some introductory historical and theological considerations concerning immigrants, offered by a relatively recent LCMS joint statement on immigration, I will argue that the confessional Lutheran distinction and relationship between the two realms, at times known as two kingdoms, and the Lutheran teaching on vocation provides us with some foundations and guidelines for thinking through the issue of immigration as it relates to Hispanic missions. The joint statement was issued by the President's Office and Lutheran World Relief and Human Care. The joint statement reminds the LCMS of its immigrant past. Quote, the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod traces its origin to 750 Saxon immigrants, end quote. Although the statement does not develop this historical reflection much further, it is still, I believe, a significant point, because in the current immigration debate, there is a sort of historical amnesia on the part of many LCMS Lutherans regarding their own immigrant roots and the struggles and prejudices that our forefathers and mothers in the faith had to struggle with upon arriving to the United States. On a recent visit I made to the Concordia Historical Institute archives in St. Louis, I read through some English language newspapers from the time of the Saxon migration that spoke, guess what, pejoratively of the new German Lutheran immigrants, looked down upon their religion, culture, and language, and even fear being too close to them, from fear of being contaminated by new ideas. newspaper articles and editorials would actually advise people to stay away from those German immigrants. That's part of our past. I include myself as a Lutheran. When Lutherans today speak the same way about Hispanic immigrants, whether legal or illegal, they have not only lost any sense of connection with their own immigrant past, but they have also lost the capacity to be in solidarity with, or at least try to understand, the real struggles of recent and new immigrants, and the dehumanizing conditions that make them migrate in the first place. By stating that, quote, with this immigration as part of its history, the LCMS has been sensitive to the needs of immigrants across its 159-year history, end quote, the joint statement of the LCMS on immigration, at the very least, perhaps in an indirect sort of way, calls for a basic sensitivity, understanding of the plight of the immigrant. So that's at least one statement made by the LCMS in an official kind of capacity, this idea of the connection to the immigrant roots, identity, and a sense of solidarity and sensitivity, understanding for that kind of situation in the contemporary scene of migration. The joint statement also reminds the church of Yahweh's concern for the stranger, the alien, in some translations even immigrant, the stranger in our midst. And the statement brings forth for the church also the example of Jesus in his gracious dealings with strangers. The statement reads, quote, "The Lord himself set the standard for responder to the stranger in our midst. Jesus Christ sought out, welcomed, and cared for people in need. He acted in mercy without respect to ethnicity, religion, or nationality," end quote. There should be, in other words, as I read this statement, a basic attitude on the part of the church, basic attitude of openness to and real concern for the needy in our midst. Due to their material and even emotional poverty, people who migrate, I would argue, typically stand, in fact, as one of the neediest neighbors in our midst. So that basic concern that Yahweh has for the needy, and specifically the alien, along with the widows and the orphans and so on, represent also a call to the church to show the same compassion. Hispanic exegete Rivera Rodriguez has argued that a number of values can be gathered from the Old Testament to affirm, quote, "the struggles and aspirations for justice and human rights of migrant workers around the world and in the United States of America," end quote. Such values would include judging rightly between peoples, giving a fair hearing to both citizen and resident alien in the community, as well as refraining from depriving the resident alien of justice or from withholding fair wages from poor migrant workers. God, in other words, calls Israel to love the stranger because they too were strangers in Egypt. And God even curses those who oppress the alien, the orphan, and the widow. In a recent book on the Bible and immigrants, Carol R. makes reference to similar Old Testament injunctions, but also gathers from the ministry of Jesus, especially his unusually inclusive treatment of the Samaritan woman for a Jew of his time, an ethic of compassion toward the outsider for the church to practice. The idea of a basic ethic or set of values based on God's fundamental attitude of concern for the stranger can be gathered from the joint statement, which concludes that, quote, "God in his word consistently shows his loving concern for the stranger in our midst and directs his people to do the same," end quote. At the same time, the joint statement wants to say something about God's institution of government. And so it reads, quote, "The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod affirms the right, responsibility, and authority of the government to act as God's agent according to what is reasonable and just in the creation and enforcement of laws." And it quotes Romans 13. On the one hand, Lutheran theology affirms that God governs the world for our well-being through government in the temporal realm. The statement affirms this teaching regarding God's left-hand kingdom or temporal realm, and by doing so also affirms the promotion of the cause of justice and peace before human beings, or coram hominibus in the Latin. And this cause of justice and peace is advanced by the government through the call for good works in society, for the promotion of family, education, and of course what government in itself can do also to advance the service of neighbor. On the other hand, while the statement teaches the authority of the government as God's agent, that's a given, it also limits such authority in the creation and implementations of laws, quote, according to what is reasonable and just. This move should not surprise us, since the neighbor's well-being is not always served well. Lutheran theology can actually distinguish between God's institution of offices, for example, in government, and particular office holders who occupy them and the laws that they come up with. Thus, we might honor government as God's gift, while at the same time protesting government and its laws when these do not serve the neighbor best. So we have here, see, a kind of a tension. Many of the debates on immigration that relate to how is the neighbor best served have to do with one's position on whether the law is actually doing that. So we don't consider the law or look to the law as an idol. See? Got to be careful with that. While affirming God's institutional government, one also thinks of how the government is actually fulfilling its obligation to serve the neighbor. And this is part of what brings up a certain ambiguity, debate, tension between Christians when it comes to this question. This is over and above a fundamental attitude to be open to the stranger in our midst, which I think all Christians, unless they have some real issues, would agree to, at least in principle. Now, the joint statement concluded in the following way. Quote, "Meanwhile, in order to fulfill our Christian obligation, we also request that the charitable act of providing assistance to undocumented aliens not otherwise engaged in illegal activity not be criminalized ipso facto. We pray that appropriate solutions may be found so that our assistance to those in need can also include helping persons become legal residents and citizens of this land of freedom and opportunity in which God has so richly blessed us." By the way, this is easier said than done. Immigration law is one of the most complex laws around, or set of laws around. So if anybody ever wants to help someone become a legal resident and citizen of the United States, it will take a considerable amount of work and effort and time. But this is portrayed in the joint statement as something that is good to do for the sake of your neighbor, given the neighbor's need and reasons for migrating and so on and so forth. This concluding statement, though, from the joint declaration or statement on immigration by the LCMS was considered by small sectors of the church to be somewhat controversial on at least two grounds. And this you gather from some of the kind of comments in various venues, including some of the written publications of Synod after the statement came out. But Some argue, for example, that undocumented aliens are already involved in illegal activity because of their undocumented status. So in other words, the statement's call to provide assistance to undocumented immigrants not otherwise involved in illegal activity is an oxymoron. All right, so that was one point that was made. The second one, others argue that the church has no right to tell the government what to do. In other words, the statement's call to the government not to criminalize the church for helping undocumented immigrants was uncalled for, since the church should not get in the way of the government. In response to these two points of difference, and to be fair to the joint statement, I would say that here in the statement, the intention was not to refer to sort of the illegality of immigration as such, but most likely the statement was referring to situations where providing humanitarian aid to an illegal immigrant known to be involved in criminal activities, such as drug or human trafficking, would only promote such activities further. Okay, so this is, I think, what was more what the statement was kind of driving at. The issue was basically one of the work of mercy. I mean, if you see someone in need, you don't ask him about their legal status. You simply extend the neighborly hand to them, you know, this kind of move. However, if you knew that these immigrants were involved in some kind of activity where your help would actually be hurting a greater number of neighbors, that's a different issue. I suppose some of these things could even include things like spousal and child abuse and stuff like that. Moreover, as to the second charge, I would point out that the joint statement was not really interested in getting in the way of the government, as much as in warning the government not to get in the way of the church. In other words, the church has a task to do also, and that is to proclaim the gospel and to do the works of mercy that flow from the gospel. So while it is true that the church should not tell the government how to legislate, although of course you can always say Christians as citizens in the world can actually come up with ways to inform the government on proper ways of serving the neighbor. But the issue here is, there is a sense in which there are situations where the church has to sort of tell the government, and perhaps this is kind of a first use of the law, even maybe second use of the law kind of thing, have to tell the government not to get in the way of the work of the church, which is to proclaim the gospel and do the works that flow from the gospel. Now, thus far, the joint statement on immigration gives you a few things to chew on. A more comprehensive Lutheran approach to the immigration issue in relation to missions among Hispanics has to consider, at least as a starting point and some a foundation at some level, the distinction between the two realms or two kingdoms or governments and the Lutheran teaching on vocation. So let me review briefly the contours of our Lutheran teaching in these areas and then raise some difficult questions for the church and some practical ways of dealing with them. The Lutheran doctrine of the two realms basically teaches that God governs the whole world, not just part of the world, but the whole thing, the whole world for our well-being. And that he does that in two ways. First, through the proclamation of the gospel in what is called the spiritual realm or government. The goal here is to redeem sinners before God, or coram Deo in the Latin, through faith in Christ. And this is done through vocations, stations, offices in the church. Secondly, God governs also the world for our well-being not only through the proclamation of the gospel, which brings us to a right relationship before God through faith in Christ, but also through the law as God's goodwill for creation. And he does this in the temporal realm or government. The goal here is to promote justice, right relationships, and peace, coram mundo, okay, before the world, before others. And this is done through vocations or stations in God's orders of marriage and government. Out of marriage, you can talk about serving also the neighbor through different relationships in family, or through education, or the economy. You know, Luther kind of drew the family, education, economy all out of marriage, in a sense. You know, that's where the first education takes place, the first kind of economy of the household takes place and all that. And from there, it goes out into the world in different ways. So that's kind of the contours of this distinction between the two realms in Lutheran theology. Now, as Christians fulfill their vocations in both realms, they should consider a number of things. See, Christians are sort of in any number of relationships to other people. So as a pastor, you have a responsibility to proclaim the gospel to God's people and give the sacraments, but you're also a father, see, or you're also a citizen. So you have a responsibility to your neighbor at different levels. So as Christians fulfill their vocations in both realms, there are a number of things to consider. First, you have to remember that for Luther, you don't just talk about fulfilling God's law kind of in general or in an abstract way. For Luther, you fulfill the law of love through vocation. See, otherwise you're always wondering about, you know, what is God's will, or what should I do, or maybe I should look for special works and, you know, maybe more spiritual works or whatever. Where in reality, your neighbor is facing you, you know. The neighbor is in your face all the time. And Luther would say, you know, if you were just take care of the neighbor whom God has placed in your midst, in the vocations that he has given you, you wouldn't have time to think about doing any special works. You know, there's just plenty to do there already. So there is a sense in which the law of love is fulfilled concretely through vocation, which means that vocation defines who is your neighbor. If everybody's your neighbor, nobody's your neighbor, see? Vocation helps you to define in a very concrete way who your neighbor is, who, in fact, your primary neighbor might be, see? Vocation also defines how you will fulfill the law for them. That's going to be looking different, looking differently for a father or a citizen and so on. Now, this is important, that the law of love is fulfilled concretely through vocation. That's a unique Lutheran contribution to this discussion. It's important because how far one is from or how close one is to the Hispanic immigrant will determine your advocacy for Hispanic immigrants. And it will determine the shape of your service to them. So if you're a pro bono immigration lawyer of Hispanic origin who works with cases of immigration, that vocation is going to shape who your neighbor is. Which neighbor should be served first? What neighbor are you going to advocate for? See? How you're going to actually serve them. If you're too far removed from any kind of solidarity with the immigrant, you might not see that necessarily as being inclusive of your vocations or something, or being included in your vocations. There is a brother here who is in admissions for Fort Wayne. Did I say just left? Yeah. Well, you know, guess what? That vocation, that's going to define who his neighbor is, right? He's supposed to stand up for, you know, those guys who want to enter the seminary. And once they're at the seminary, he's, you know, supposed to advocate for them. That's good. We shouldn't expect any less. I think this is interesting because when the joint statement on immigration came up, there were people who were, you know, kind of all bent out of shape because LCMS, World Relief and Human Care has something to say on immigrants. My goodness, that's part of their vocation. They better say something about immigrants. My goodness, you know, Human Care, you know, mercy, come on, you know. Give him a break, you know. Vocation defines who is your neighbor, even your primary neighbor, and how you will actually fulfill the law for them. On the other hand, the law of love is above vocation. This is also important. Now, we want to talk about fulfilling the law of love through vocation, but also, in a sense, the law of love is above vocation. What this means is that you can't say something like, well, because you don't really enter within the purview of my vocations now, I'm not going to help you. You can't do that. Vocational focus should not exclude any neighbor who's actually in need. So it raises the questions. In an increasingly Latino nation, or in context where you have a growing Latino community, can you actually say something like, well, that's not part of my vocation in this place, in this historical time? You know, it makes you think. Maybe Hispanic immigrants are needy neighbors too. Maybe they fit in some kind of vocation for me if I am not too far removed from them. So again, some questions to think about in defining what level of commitment, solidarity, advocacy, service you will do for Hispanic immigrants. It's something to think about. I think that's kind of a, you have to kind of personally struggle a little bit through that, deal with that. Everyone agrees that we should serve the neighbor. That's not the point. The point is, how is the neighbor best served? Or which neighbor should be served first? That becomes often a matter of intense and legitimate debate and even disagreement among Christians. Okay? So no wonder there is some kind of tension here on the immigration issue. Now, living in more than one realm, then, is not an easy thing, is it? Because there's always going to be different neighbors that are going to be calling out for your service. And you have to, at some point, prioritize. We all have more than one vocation. Where the Hispanic immigrant fits in there, you have to kind of wrestle with that. I'm not going to tell you. I work for the Center for Hispanic Studies at Concordia Seminary. This is why I can talk about stuff like this. Moreover, this is why I could probably even stand up for the Hispanic immigrant in some settings. Okay, because it just naturally flows from the charge I've been given and my vocation. And I don't apologize about it. You do the same thing, whatever your vocation is. Each Christian has been called to serve the neighbor in both realms in the particular vocations he has been given. And because Christians hold more than one vocation and are responsible to many people at the same time, conflict between vocation is going to happen. The necessity of setting some priorities, that's going to happen. There is then legitimate ambiguity and tension. Now, let me illustrate this for you. One of the routes that Mexican immigrants coming to the United States across the border take is the Arizona desert. Okay, and there are many deaths each year from people who try to cross the border there at that point. It's a very inhospitable land. A theologian by the name of Daniel Grudy, who teaches at the University of Notre Dame, a Roman Catholic father, wrote a book where he talks about sort of the experience of the migrants and also put together this documentary that at some point you should watch. I think it's called something like Dying to Live, an immigrant's journey or something like that, documentary. And he relates the story of this Mexican father who is crossing the border because he needs to provide for his children. If I were to show you statistics of poverty, global statistics of poverty, and specifically of poverty in Mexico. Mexico has a high level of malnourishment, for children and high levels of poverty. The number one reason why people migrate is because of economic need. It's a very, very, very small percentage that wants to do drug trafficking and stuff like that, you know. So to paint a broad picture and say that, you know, all immigrants are coming here for evil purposes, it's just not true. And so this father who's crossing the border almost died. And he's picked up by the border patrol, thankfully. And he survived. And Father Grudy asked him, when you thought that you were almost dead, what were you thinking about? And he said, I was thinking of the temptation of Christ. I said, what do you mean by that, the temptation of Christ? Well, I was in the desert, and the devil was tempting me not to cross so that I could provide for my children. Now, it's interesting, you know, because usually when you're on the other side of the border, you might think, no, the temptation would be to cross because that's breaking the law. You see? But for this father, the temptation was not to cross because that would have implied that he would not be fulfilling his obligation to his children. Here we have vocational conflicts, right? Because on the one side of the border, you have the father who wants to fulfill the fifth commandment, thou shalt not kill, which means also promote your family, your neighbor's well-being. That's what he's doing. He's a father. How can you expect any less of him? What's he supposed to do? Let the children go hungry? Now, on the other hand, we're thinking, well, fourth commandment, right? Obey the authorities. You're not supposed to cross. The temptation would be to do that. It's how, you know? What, are you going to pit the fourth commandment against the fifth? You see why dealing with this problem in terms of sort of fulfilling the law in the abstract doesn't make much sense. You have to think through it via vocation. That is what how people concretely fulfill the law. Otherwise, you can have all kinds of discussions about what laws you broke. So you have to sort of think through this in terms of vocation. What are, it could be that the father actually agrees that crossing the border is illegal. But he has a greater priority and obligation to his children. So he will put the fifth commandment, in a sense, kind of above in terms of priority in relationship to the fourth. You see how these questions are not sort of black and white. See? On the other hand, a border patrol agent might actually disagree with immigration law. But he wants to fulfill his vocation because that's what he has been given. So he will go and stop those who want to cross the border illegally. And can you blame him? No. That's his vocation. See? He's fulfilling the fourth commandment, that is promoted, that the authorities, civil authorities, are obeyed. Even though he might disagree with immigration law. And I know Border Patrol agents would do. But this is their duty. Only if there is a problem of conscience where you cannot deal with that ambiguity, then you should just do something else. But this is part of the tension of living in both realms. See, that's what happens. So anyways, that's an example of how, because we live in both realms and we have more than one vocation, we have to sort of prioritize, make decisions. And we do that in the best way we can. And then if, you know, we committed some sin by doing it, well, then we just leave that up all to God. We just give it all to God and say, God, forgive me if I did something I wasn't supposed to. But don't just stand there and do nothing. Vocation, then, our lesson here is that vocation is a concrete way you serve your neighbor and fulfill God's law. Like this Mexican father crossing the border, trying to fulfill the fifth commandment through his vocation as father. So there are ways maybe that you can sort of deal with this. One possibility is that when there is a conflict of vocational duties and responsibilities, priority goes to the neediest. So in this case, the father might agree that crossing the border is illegal against the fourth commandment. And yet he's going to do it. Why? Because when there is a conflict of vocational duties and responsibilities, the priority will go to the neediest neighbor. In this case, his children and family. So that's one way of sort of dealing with the ambiguity without completely resolving the tension. I can think, for example, of my own children. Lucas is now 7, Anna is 4. When they were a little younger, Lucas would come over and say, Papi, I want to play. And Anna, the younger one, you know, would have a poopy diaper and want some milk. Well, I love them both. That's not the question. I want to serve my neighbor. They're my neighbor. That's not the question. But there is certainly a conflict of vocational priority here, you know. Now, who do you go to first? The neediest, right? See? That's one way of dealing with the ambiguity, even if at times that's not completely going to make Lucas happy. At least not right away. Or, you know, perhaps an easier situation, a church member is in a critical condition in the hospital on the much anticipated day of your daughter's wedding, of course, which you promised to be at. Well, serve the neediest neighbor first, ask God and your daughter for forgiveness later. Now, what's another practical way that we can deal with the ambiguity? Well, here's another way. When it comes to your own life and what happens to you, you can turn the other cheek if you want. You know, in other words, if I'm an undocumented immigrant and I live with my family here, or let's say if I'm an undocumented immigrant and I live by myself, let's just begin that way. I live by myself, I don't have family here, you know. And, you know, I engage in context or whatever where I'm likely to be caught and deported. Well, you know, that's probably just fine. You know, that's just me. I could probably try to make it back again if I make it through the desert. If I'm willing to risk my life again, you know. But what if that person has family with him? That kind of changes the dynamics all of a sudden. You know, because if something happens to him, the whole family is all of a sudden without a father. There are issues of family unity. Now, what do you do with that? So I guess what I'm saying with this is kind of like this. In terms of the individual Christian's responsibility to his neighbor, the Christian has no other choice but to promote the neighbor's well-being and defend the neighbor's life. When it comes to what you want to do with my own life individually, that's something else. Let me give you an example of this. If a gunman enters my house, I might be able to resign myself to suffer and die if my life is in danger. Now, knowing me, I think I probably won't go down without a fight. Okay? But you could turn the other cheek in situations like that. But I know that I will probably not go down without a fight and perhaps even kill if necessary to protect my family. Because now you're not just dealing with me individually. Now you're dealing with the neighbor whom I have been called to serve and protect. That brings a whole different dynamic on it. So before you turn the other cheek, think about the neighbor that you're supposed to serve. Something to think about. Before you think about being a good Christian citizen and turning someone in because he's undocumented, or you think he is, so you're going to call immigration to deal with this problem or something, you got to think about, hey, what about family connections and things like that? What would I do to the family if I did that? Would I put in danger not only the family unity, but would I put in danger the means for this family to survive? And you know, and there are kids of illegal immigrants in this country who attend schools. They don't speak any Spanish sometimes. They speak only English. All their friends are here in the United States. You pull the father out, they all go. What's that going to do? And where are they going to be sent to? To the place where they came from? Where you have issues of poverty and malnourishment? And I tell you, when people migrate, You know, they don't migrate for fun. That's no fun. You're leaving your house, your language, culture, family, to migrate. If I wanted to have fun migrating, I go to Disney World, you know. That's a different ballgame. Well, maybe you won't. Maybe you go to German Fest or something. You know, but that's something to consider. So try to be sensitive to the responsibilities that someone has towards other neighbors. One thing is to deal with someone as an individual. Another thing is to deal with someone who's connected to people who depend for their livelihood on them. The Mexican father doesn't say, who crosses the desert, you know, he doesn't say, well, I'm not going to cross because I don't, you know, I don't want to be illegal. I don't want to disobey the law. Well, as an individual, he can do that. He can say, I'm just not going to do it because, you know, fourth commandment, you got to keep that. But you know what? He doesn't have that choice really because he is a father. Too bad. So you got to deal with that. How are you going to do it? See, now that's a corporate responsibility that he has. He can no longer just turn the cheek and do whatever he wants as an individual. He has to consider his family. So the Mexican father who crosses the border does not give up. And in fact, sins boldly, you might say, for the sake of his hungry children. Third point here. So the first point was that we live in both realms, and that means that you have to see who your neighbor is, and that will define how you serve them according to the vocations you've been given, and that will bring some conflict. So when that happens, serve the neediest. I'm not saying that's always going to solve everything, but what I'm saying is one practical guideline. The second point was, what you do as an individual or to someone as an individual is different than what you do corporately because you're related to others who depend on you. And how you deal with people who are also in relationships with others who depend on him. So you can turn the other cheek when it comes to only one person. When it comes to the responsibilities that person has towards others, think twice. Okay? That's another kind of practical guideline, something to consider. The third one is something that I have mentioned already in a sense here, that vocation actually allows you to advocate for some neighbor. You think about the Mexican father and the border patrol agent, they're both doing their duty. They're both serving the neighbor according to the vocation they have been given. Who is really living faithfully? It's a both and thing. They're both doing it. So a vocation establishes who's your closest neighbor and how you serve them. And that should define significantly your advocacy and so on. So don't be afraid to actually, you know, what I think you can pretty much come on any side of the immigration debate you want as long as you're actually advocating for some neighbor. If not, that really ticks me off. You know, in other words, don't deal with the law as something sort of general. You know, when people say, well, you know, if someone breaks the law, well, that's illegal and they shouldn't be here. Well, okay, what neighbor exactly are you arguing for? From what vocational standpoint are you arguing for? Or are you just kind of talking in generalities? Show me your neighbor. Then you can go ahead and defend and stand up for some concrete neighbor. Okay? So it's something that we should not be afraid of. So if you could actually say things like, you know, I'm going to advocate for the National Security Board security position because I'm thinking of the neighbor as, you know, the people who live along the border or whatever. See? And I'm concerned for their well-being. Well, then, you know, I might disagree with your argument, but at least you're actually bringing up a neighbor that you want to stand for and advocate for. See, that makes more sense to me than simply talking about the law in general. Another consideration as you deal with the issue of immigration. Keep in mind that although you live in both realms, that means that you're a pastor who's been called to proclaim the gospel and give the sacraments, but also you're a citizen, right? You live in both realms. You want to be faithful, both. But remember this, what you do in one realm could affect what you can do in another. What you do in one realm can affect what you do in another. So for example, if you're in an increasingly Latino neighborhood and you are planning to do missions among Latinos, but for some reason you decide to be a faithful Christian, dutiful citizen and call immigration to deal with some people you suspect are illegals, everyone in that community is going to know it was you. They're not going to say, oh, no, he was doing that as a Christian citizen. No, people don't make that distinction. They say, that's the pastor, the guy who wears the collar. He's the one who called my immigration. See? Now, what's that going to do to your ministry? See? It'd be very difficult to reach out to Latinos who would just be immediately suspicious of you because you don't care for them. So even though, technically speaking, you could do that, you probably shouldn't if the gospel is going to suffer. But again, you might choose to go the other way. And you say, you know, I'm willing to take care of the problem of illegal immigration in my neighborhood. And if the gospel is not proclaimed to these people, well, so be it. That's your call. But that's, again, ways of dealing with this situation. So the lesson here is this. You might have to refrain from doing publicly what you would otherwise be able to do freely as a citizen. And why might you have to refrain? For the sake of serving the greatest number of neighbors with the gospel. That's a possible way of dealing with this. Let me give you another example that maybe is a little bit closer. It doesn't have to do with the immigration issue. Without your collar on, all right? Let's say you take your collar off, and you, as a citizen of the United States, you go out and protest peacefully at an abortion clinic. All right? Now you're saying, by taking your collar off, you say, I'm doing it as a citizen. That's my right and duty in the left-hand realm. But everybody in the neighborhood knows that you are a man of the cloth, whether you're wearing your collar or not. So as a result, they see you, you know, doing political activism or something like that, you know. The same works if you go to a pro-immigration rally or something like that. Well, people are they're not going to see you as, you know, Douglas Grohl, the private citizen. They're going to see you as Douglas Grohl, the guy who, you know, preaches on Sundays at that church. And as a result of your political activism, some people will not want to go to your church because I don't want to go to a church that gets involved in this politics. And others will want to go to your church because you get involved in politics, you know. So again, what I do here on the left-hand realm as a citizen, my effect, what I am able to accomplish over here in the spiritual realm as one who's been called to proclaim the word of God and to serve the community with the works of mercy that flow from the gospel. So I'm not giving you an easy answer, but I am telling you, if the gospel is going to get heard at the end, and if your primary responsibility in that community is to proclaim the gospel, then, you know, just kind of think about that. Understand the consequences of your actions for your neighbor and for the ministry of the gospel. So, if I were to, now, again, many things to think about. I have painted a complex picture for you, once again, because immigration is a complex issue to deal with theologically. And at times you have to solve the tension one way or another. What I'm giving you are some guidelines that I think are theologically tenable to sort of deal with the tension and the conflict that exists sometimes between being a pastor, missionary who has been called to proclaim the gospel to God's people and the surrounding community, and also a Christian citizen who wants to be faithful to the law of the land. Okay, so no easy answers either. But do consider, though, that your vocation is not a bad starting point to begin. What is it that you have been called to do in this or that place, and how what you do might affect your ability to actually do that? So to help you think a little bit more through that, I have developed another case study. So listen to this one and see how you might resolve the tension. You have been called to serve a predominantly Anglo parish in an increasingly Latino neighborhood. Somewhat familiar? A prominent Anglo member of your congregation who serves in the city council is rather vocal in and outside the church about his opposition to illegal immigration. Members of the Latino community, whose legal status is simply unknown, are increasingly hesitant to attend outreach church activities because of their fear that this zealous citizen or others in the church might call the immigration officers to check them out. As a result, the congregation's evangelistic and mercy efforts in the community are not trusted. The situation has gotten so bad that a concerned Latino member of the congregation, who works pro bono as an immigration lawyer, will not commune with this Anglo brother because of the latter's lack of sensitivity to the plight of the immigrant and the Latino community in their midst. Now, you're the pastor here. You have to talk to the vocal citizen here, Anglo member of the congregation. We just won't shut up. And he's driving everyone away from the church. And at the same time, you got to talk to this, also in his own way, zealous Latino member who's committed to the community, to the plight of the immigrant, but doesn't want to commune with this Anglo member because of his opposition to illegal immigration. You have to talk to both of these gentlemen. How will you handle it? You have any thoughts? Yeah, please.
I think what you've already done so well is help us to understand the human experience of this man. And I lived on the border in Mexico for 3 years, lived in Texas for 9 years. And it's a well-known documented fact that Houston and Dallas were built by Mexican immigrants. And our very own George Bush did not enforce immigration laws that were on the books in Texas. And in fact, the state of Texas and our government really pretty much tolerated and allowed the immigration to happen. They could have enforced it. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so when it becomes convenient, then we want to start enforcing it when it's convenient to us. And so you participate in a lie because that's your only option. So, like you said, when the person's trying to serve their family, kind of over here, they're participating in a lie. And I'll just show my cards that the U.S. government is participating in too. That immigration is illegal. That no, we're not gonna go after it because it's great for our economy. It's cheaper labor. I may not go that far and try to explain it, but just trying to give that person, that Anglo, that this is a human, these are human beings, there's another part of that human experience that they can understand. It's not as cut and dry. God's law does not change and it's right. That's not always true with man's law. The midwives in Egypt did not fulfill Pharaoh's wishes.
Yeah. Yeah, you raise any number of issues. Thank you for that. One of the interesting things is, you know, this the shift after 9/11 was really monumental in many ways. I remember coming to the United States as on a student visa when I first came to live with the family in Iowa that you mentioned earlier. I remember that I left my student visa in the suitcase or something like that. So they stopped me and they said, well, no problem, you know, just whenever you get to Iowa, just send it, you know. Everything will be okay. You know, that'll never happen now. It'll never happen now. But it shows you. And the same thing with the undocumented immigrants. There was kind of a lax attitude towards the law because businesses were sort of reaping the benefits of the labor. But at the same time, there was a flow of migration all the time. So that people would go to Mexico, come back seasonally to work. They would have been undocumented, perhaps. But, you know, there was some laxity on the law because it was perceived that the benefits in some ways of immigrant labor would outweigh in some ways the benefits of fulfilling the law or the letter of the law, one might say. But after 9/11, you have this concern for securing borders, which means that you don't have this easy flow of migration, which is sort of expected everywhere in the world. I mean, a globalized economy where you need sort of free flow of movements and peoples works that way. But when you have a post-9/11 world and that's closed, now anyone who crosses is going to be very hard for that person to sort of go back, to come back again. That's not going to happen. So in some ways, it increases the problem, you know. Not to mention that after 9/11, Immigration and Naturalization Office was put under Homeland Security, which gives the impression that any immigrant who crosses illegally is a terrorist or is a threat to the nation. How many Mexicans do you know that drive on planes or ride planes into buildings? Not many. Then you have immigration quotas, which want to give the same number of visas to people from, you know, anywhere from Mexico to some country that you've never heard in your life. Well, when you have Mexico next to the United States, wouldn't it make sense to provide a greater number of visas to the Mexicans? You know, immigration law is complex, and there are some things that are just difficult to deal with. I'm not saying that that's not the occasion. But we have created a situation where a Mexican immigrant has sort of mixed messages. On the one hand, you know, it's sort of like saying something like, if you're willing to risk your life and cross the border, there will be a job waiting for you. That's the mixed message, you know? So people take it. So immigration law has to really, it's a big complex issue. Yes, please. Yeah, Chris Meyer, right? Yeah.
He is a 99 graduate of Fort Wayne. He was mm-hmm. called for the Fort
Wayne. Yeah, yeah.
And he's serving down there. And I think I'm very glad to be able to tell him some of the things he shared with you today, because he's had to, his own vocation, you know, figure out all these kind of things.
Yeah.
That our country really is concerned about the exploitation of Mexicans being brought into the country, mm-hmm. and for nothing else than, you know, by Mexicans themselves, who are exploiting their fellow citizens.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an issue that is real.
Yeah. No, and I like that too, because it paints a different picture on the Border Patrol person. I mean, we don't have to demonize a Border Patrol person. I mean, they're fulfilling their vocation, and many times they do have a real concern, even humanitarian concern, for the immigrant. Like the guy who found the Mexican father in the desert before he died.
Yeah,
in a sense, it saved his life.
Yeah, that happens all the time.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. So we want to affirm that to some extent too.